mindfulness as moral law, or the instruction to be mindful of anger without judgment and without trying to change it is wrong view. So the idea is that, first of all, in the Eightfold Path, if effort precedes mindfulness in this sequence, there's a precondition for judging arising experiences or states as wholesome or unwholesome, and then taking active steps to increase the wholesome and decrease the unwholesome. How does one know what the unwholesome and unwholesome is? And you go back to wise view, which points to the precepts as primary guide. Right? Because wise view is comprised of seeing experience in the light of the Four Noble Truths, and the Four Noble Truths ends in the Eightfold Path, and the Eightfold Path contains wise action, speech, and livelihood, which are the precepts. And so, if the preconditions for mindfulness are having accepted the precepts, and then we can remember that the, you know, admission to the Sangha consists essentially of taking refuge and precepts. So accepting the logic of the precepts, agreeing to them. With that as the precondition, then the practitioner knows how to assess what's wholesome and unwholesome, which, if one doesn't have a guideline, one has to trust one's inner intuition, which is, of course, always subject to being wrong. Part of this comes from a reflection on correct perception and misperception as being two of the forms of mental patterning in the Patanjali's Yoga Sutra. So in mindfulness, there's not only the noticing of what is moment to moment, but there's an analysis of it, because it has to be analyzed in order to know whether it's wholesome or unwholesome. What this analysis includes is actually some or a fair amount of cognitive activity. When an experience arises, especially one that is a deep pattern, and again, thinking about Patanjali, his use of the word chittavritti as mental patterns, or heart patterns, consciousness patterns, if the main things that we have to watch out for that cause suffering are patterns, like grasping, hatred, and delusion, in all their forms, then we have to know them for what they are when they arise. And if we haven't done some analysis to actually recognize grasping, hatred, and delusion as they arise, we might not take them seriously enough. Meaning, we might think that they're the kind of perception to be noted impartially without reaction. The way that, like, you know, a neutral sound might be noted and really not have any much pattern charge at all, other than basic perception, sanya, recognition. And so relatively easy to let go of. The things, of course, that everyone struggles with are the deep patterns that don't just disappear upon being noticed impartially. And I think this is partly because they are moral at their root. So, of course, we can take the pattern called racism and the sub-pattern called racial bias, and then we can look at the interwoven pattern of white supremacy and white centrism and white privilege. and then be very compassionate about folks who are the recipients of all that privilege and centrism, white folks who are unaware of their whiteness, as a kind of, you know, blissful innocence, at least temporarily, because they haven't done the analysis to show that their unconscious pattern is unwholesome. And so they could be aware, for instance, while walking down the street in a dangerous neighborhood, that they feel a little uneasy near a young black man. And they don't have the education in patterns, in wholesomeness and unwholesomeness, to be mindful of that discomfort as anything other than a reflection of the truth, right? And even if it's not a reflection of the truth of the other person, it would just be a reflection of the truth of their own emotional state. I feel afraid, period. And they might think like, oh, you know, I don't want to be as afraid, I want to develop some more bravery or something. But that's not the same as an analysis that says, oh, the thing to be mindful of here is not my own fear, which is kind of the direct emotional response, but actually the patterns that give rise to that fear, which are systemic, of course. And so if that person goes and does racism education, whiteness education, they will wake up to, or become mindful to, or develop mindfulness of patterns that they carry around and reproduce that they now know, post-analysis, are unwholesome. And then seeing them as unwholesome, right, wise effort says one should do one's best to get rid of it. So then my historical hypothesis is that the teachers, the first generation Western teachers who really produced this doctrine of non-judgment, non-judgmental present moment awareness. And so, of course, that's, you know, Dr. Kabat-Zinn and Blessed Jack and Joseph and Sharon and all the rest, who really put their weight on the non-judgment side of mindfulness, or of mindfulness as a morally neutral observation. My historical guess is that their doing that arose from the confluence of two forces, one of which was the kind of late 60s hippie rebellion against 1950s normalcy, which many of them were at least tangentially part of, certainly generationally part of. And so a resistance to Christian orthodoxy as well, with its strong emphasis on guilt. And we just listened to a beautiful quote of Ajahn Pasano, trying to explain to a Thai Theravada teacher what guilt was, because he realized after having been translated there for many, many years, he didn't know, there wasn't a Thai word that translated as guilt. So that's a side note, but the mention of guilt partly comes from his mention there. That's a footnote, yes. So then the hippies' predisposition away from any form of discipline, disciplining the self in any way, then gets, I think, unintentionally supported by the rather tantric Zen teachings that were established here that really talked about like a kind of absolute non-judgment, or a non-judgment even that arises from contact with the absolute. Like the quote from Suzuki Roshi, who says, you know, to just be mindful of anger. Essentially, he says the anger of a Buddha is like a bright red sunset. And I think the Western students took that teaching as encouragement to indulge their own anger by saying that, you know, well, at least I'm just being mindful of it, and I'm being non-judgmental, and therefore I'm working on self-acceptance. So this, I think, the resistance of the West to see mindfulness as a basically moral endeavor elides with the desperate need of Western students to work on self-acceptance above all. So, So Suzuki is saying that the anger of a Buddha is like a bright red sunset. I don't know of any defense for that, any support for that in the Pali texts. But if I reflected on it, just as a saying unto itself, I would note a couple things about sunsets. One of which is that they're not very scary for most people, I think. And another is that they're very short. And so the flare-up that is bright red really, it lasts a few minutes at most, and it's constantly changing. And then it fades to a very cooled-out darkness, which, of course, is the old metaphor for nibbana or nirvana, that which is cooled, or a lamp that has gone out. So maybe the anger of a Buddha being like a bright red sunset is actually a way of saying the anger of the Buddha is the activity of that anger disappearing quickly. So there's that. So then the Western doctrine of mindfulness as a absolutely non-judgmental present moment awareness, what if it's wrong? What if it's actually wrong view? That the teachers who pushed that doctrine were actually under the spell of a pattern of suffering all their own. And of course they were. But in this very particular way, right? Of course we all are. But for them in a very particular way, that the need to practice and teach self-acceptance and the need to resist societal orthodoxy elided into a teaching that leaned hard on the absolute or non-dual aspects of Theravada, particularly through strong support from Zen and the other non-dual tantras being established here at the same time or a little bit later, like the Tibetan Dzogchen and Mahamudra, etc., and then Advaita itself. Right, and so you get a teacher like Jack studying both with Ajahn Chah, who has a very strong and clear, simple in a certain way, moral teaching, with Sri Nisargadatta, who really only directs folks to the absolute pretty consistently, which is a beautiful and liberating teaching, but it's also in a certain way amoral. And I wouldn't say that as I don't say that as a critique to Nisargadatta, partly because I think that his ethic, I would imagine, was so fully embedded in his Indianness culturally that to emphasize it as a necessary or radical aspect of his teaching might have been just superfluous. Like, you can realize the absolute, but you already have a basis in non-harming, etc., through the ancient kind of parallel ideals of Hindu ethics. So many of our teachers studied both with essentially, Theravada and Mahayana teachers, and so then absorbed, this very kind of non-dual approach to ethics and to the mind, of course, where there are the beautiful, beautiful tantric teachings about, letting the mind be just as it is without intervention, accepting the, all of the shadow parts, and in the truly tantric systems, really, really integrating those in a very profound and kind of psychodrama kind of way. But I would argue that the Theravada is simpler and more direct psychologically than those systems. If we recognize that mindfulness is not a thought-free process, and that it's not an ethics-free process, but that it's embedded in taking on the non-normative ethics of the five precepts and the refuges, and that once one has done that, one's compass becomes set toward a noble vision of what wholesome and unwholesome really are. And all of the impulses towards self-preservation, greed, dominance of others, are revealed, are brought up out of the darkness of unconscious habit, of societal habit, of systemic habit. And they must be, or else liberation isn't attained. I just talked with a friend who's studying at a tantric ashram in Thailand for many years, and we were talking about homophobia and aversion within the kind of aversion to homosexuality justified as being the nature of reality or the nature of the religion, at least. And so, and how hard it was for this student, who is a progressive, very gay-friendly Californian, to square their growing faith in the tradition and the religion with the obvious homophobia of the teachers, and who are not European, or sorry, who are not American. And so, you know, a sense that doctrines that privilege the absolute can be used in support of a mindfulness that emphasizes non-judgment and non-intervention, but that kind of practice can unintentionally prolong the suffering that comes from being subject to the profoundly hidden patterns of dukkha, of distress, that are embedded in our conditioning.